Welcome back. It's a Wednesday, the 14th day of November, 2018. I'm your host, Mark Hall, and what a Wednesday. You know what, folks? It's gotten to the point where so much of the news is downright unbelievable that it's even hard to sort through it in half an hour. Even so, where we're headed seems increasingly obvious. I look for the headline any day now that says, Democrats perfect election theft, realize there's no point in having a 2020 election, declare Hitlery king. Oh, and then declare themselves the party. End of story. Meanwhile, though, the bogus votes just keep on coming, like maggots from a corpse. We'll no doubt come back to some of that in a few minutes, but let's start with some news that somehow or other, even in the midst of tragedy, or maybe especially, your host just found downright hilarious. From the Woolsey and Hill fires in Southern California, which are burning Malibu. In the midst of volumes of stories about A-list and B-list and C-list celebrities who've lost their homes, I saw this headline this morning from the Daily Mail. I guess the UK is particularly stunned when Americans actually talk about guns, but maybe all of us can agree, when it comes from Hollywood, that really is eyebrow-raising. Here's the headline. Pink's husband, Carrie Hart, and you got to wonder who's Pink, yeah, some kind of a singer, warns that wildfire looters will be shot on sight and urges fellow Californians, are you sitting down, to defend your land with your Second Amendment rights after the couple were forced to evacuate their $110 million home on the beach. You've probably heard the joke. It's funny because it's true. A big city conservative is a liberal who's been mugged, even if sometimes it's only by reality. I guess now to that we can add, a California Second Amendment supporter is someone who worries that their multi-million dollar home may be looted after a fire. And suddenly, guns are okay. Well, if the right people have them. And perhaps more importantly, if you're a leftist and rich and or famous enough, you can actually get away with talking about it, and it's different somehow, like with so many other hypocrisies. Here's the rest of the headline summary. Carrie Hart, age 43, issued the warning to looters in a post on Instagram Tuesday, saying, there have been sightings of looters breaking into homes. Well, if you are a looter, think twice if you're heading back into Malibu. The caption was paired with an old-timey-looking photo of a bunch of men holding firearms with a sign that reads, looters will be shot on sight. They do have modern rifles, though, and one of them sitting on a motorcycle. And the story tells us that Hart and his wife Pink were among the 250,000 people forced to evacuate their homes in Southern California. As the Woolsey and Hill fires have now torched about 100,000 acres, their $110 million Malibu beachside home reportedly escaped the flames, and officials, I guess heeding the warning that even Hollywood types are starting to get upset about it, have announced that law enforcement has been dispatched to the evacuated areas. Guess whose homes they'll service first? After a number of reports of looting. And inquiring minds still want to know, were the multiple fires arson or just gross incompetence? But I guess that does make arson easier, doesn't it? Either way, though, PG&E and SoCal Ed are in the hot seat today. The stocks of two California power companies have plummeted bigly amid the possibility that they might be found liable for California's deadly wildfires that have now killed something on the order of 50 people. But many more still remain missing. Pacific Gas and Electric Company, or PG&E, saw their shares drop almost by half, 48%, in the 2 days of trading since the horrific campfire began last Thursday. It's now the deadliest blaze in California history, having not only killed almost four dozen people, but destroying more than 7,000 structures. And as the fire continued to burn earlier in the week, trading was briefly suspended while PG&E became the worst performing stock on the S&P 500 index. Part of the problem is that a woman named Betsy Ant Cowley, who owns land in Pugla, where the huge campfire blaze began, said that PG&E had emailed her the day before about having problems with their high power lines, citing sparks. While further south, Southern California Edison experienced a power outage in the area where the Woolsey fire began that occurred just 2 minutes before the first reports of fire started coming in. The cause of the fire is still officially under investigation, and the companies have decided they're not going to comment on what may or may not be going on, not only there, but with their shares. The Daily Mail points out the companies literally could be looking at billions of dollars worth of damages because California is one of just two states that hold electric power companies entirely liable for damage caused by their equipment, even if they followed all the safety precautions. Not to worry, though. Governor Moonbeam signed a new law back in September, making it easier for utility companies to stick it to their customers so that they don't go bankrupt. And what do you bet, says your cynical host, and I am actually already seeing comments from the leftists, that the ultimate solution may just involve rewilding all of these areas and getting rid of all those pesky peons off the land that are trying to do things we don't want them to do anyway, like live and farm. And yeah, some have non-electric cars, too. Ooh, I just had a really scary thought, folks. Suppose it was a Tesla or a Prius that had burst into flame and caused these fires, instead of a public-private partner power company. We'd probably have some Hollywood heads exploding and causing even more fires. We do, though, have to turn to the dreaded Ruskies for a bit more follow-up on the fires. This is a piece from Sputnik News headlined, "Stop Lying! There's Outrage as the California Wildfires Burn a Toxic Nuclear Site." They start with the usual introduction about how much land has been burned, how many houses, structures, and people have had their lives destroyed. And then it points out that the Santa Susana Field Laboratory, or SSFL, a former nuclear and aeronautical research facility that suffered a long undisclosed, imagine that, partial nuclear meltdown all the way back in 1959, has been named among the sites affected by the Southern Fire, the Woolsey Fire. Last week, California authorities said in a statement that the fire was moving away from the SSFL site and that it has not caused, quote, any releases of hazardous materials that would pose a risk to people exposed to the smoke, unquote. So, yeah, not to worry. Have they ever lied to you before? Maybe that's the problem. The statement, it says, has apparently failed to quell the fears of local activists and green campaigners. Ain't it funny, folks, how the same people who don't believe a word they say when their lives are at stake are more than happy to swallow the Kool-Aid when it comes to rigged elections? Oh, well, back to the story. More and more residents have basically begun to believe that the government has failed to warn them in time. And given what's been going on at so many other places, not only around the country but the world, like in Fukushima, it is kind of hard to blame them for finally becoming skeptical that when Big Brother's talking to you and their lips are moving, they might be lying. And irony of ironies, they're here, says Kristen Taylor for the Gateway Pundit. The migrant caravan has reached the U.S. border at San Diego and started climbing the fence. The first waves, it says, of the mercenary migrants, totaling about 500, surprise, mostly men, reached the U.S. border at San Diego earlier this week. And a group of between 350 and 400 climbed a tall border fence in an act of defiance as Border Patrol agents watched from a distance. Some taunted Border Patrol officials on the U.S. side before finally climbing back over the fence to Mexico. A few days earlier, a smaller group of about 85 migrants arrived in Tijuana, accompanied by U.S. lawyers paying their expenses. And you might even have some suspicions about which leftist groups are paying for those lawyers. But if you think about hundreds and hundreds of new potential far-left voters coming to where else, California, you might be able to connect some dots. Which brings us back now to the election rigging that happens after the first wave of votes, both legal and illegal, are already done. So after a judge last week found Broward County in violation of their constitution and ordered the election supervisor sick, the unindicted criminal Brenda Snipes to allow ballot inspections immediately... And she didn't. A recount is now taking place. As Jim Hoff puts it, Republicans have already lost at least one more race in Florida since election night. And the story focuses on the race that Republican Matt Caldwell won for the state agricultural commissioner. When the initial smoke cleared, he'd won the race by about 40,000 votes. But then after 3 days of vote manufacturing in Broward County, Matt is suddenly down 3,000 votes. When he joined Fox and Friends to discuss the ongoing corruption in Broward County, he told the host it just plain wasn't possible for there to be 83,000 new votes since Tuesday. Quote, "We were up by 40,000 votes on Tuesday night. Based on what was reported, there was only a possibility the 30,000 more votes could still come in from Broward. So we declared victory, went to bed, and over the next 4 days, they found 80,000 plus ballots, as you've already said." And Snipes has refused to say just how many more votes they intend to manufacture and then count. So what that seems to mean for places like Broward County is what we're now finding out. Votes really are like cockroaches. If you leave them alone in the dark, they multiply. Here's a shocker, and clearly a related story. The Florida Department of State last week asked federal prosecutors to investigate official election documents that had the dates changed. which the department says can be tied to the Florida Democratic Party. And it's not just Broward County. There are at least four counties that may have been engaged in the chicanery, with Broward just the most spectacularly obvious. Even Florida Senator Marco Rubio has finally found his voice and decided to speak out about the unbelievable in-your-face corruption after high-powered crooked lawyers from all over the country have descended on Florida in order to steal the Senate and gubernatorial elections. Senator Rubio tweeted late Tuesday evening that Democrat lawyers are actually asking a judge in Florida to change election laws there after the election so they can go back and steal the Senate and governor seats. Here's how he put it. Imagine if an NFL team was trailing in the final seconds of a game but hit a three-point kick to win it. Then after the game, lawyers for the losing team get a judge to order the rules changed so that late field goals are only worth 1 point. Well, that's, he said, how Democrat lawyers plan to steal the Florida election. For example, Florida law, whatever that's worth, requires that the voter's signatures on mail-in ballots match the signature of the voter. Who could have thought it? But them lawyers are now asking a judge to throw that law out and force Florida to count ballots with signatures that don't match the ones on file. And I guess, folks, that if you can change the dates and count votes after the polls closed, why not change the signatures, too? Heck, why bother to have people actually vote at all? Why not just let the communists tell us what the vote should have been anyway? And if they change their minds later, well, yeah, they just change the laws, too. They've already done it with the Constitution and what was once called ex post facto laws, so why not? But that does remind me of something, folks. Remember back when a fellow who actually believed in the Constitution, and worse still, the Ten Commandments, Judge Roy Moore in Alabama, was running for Senate? They pulled a Brett Kavanaugh on him, too, for being accused of something probably less disgusting than what Jim Acosta got away with on national TV. But do you remember the discussion in the press and in the Senate? They were going to ignore the election. And even if Judge Moore won the race in spite of what they did to him in the press, the Senate had said they just might not even seat the guy and have the sergeant-at-arms block him from coming into the chamber. Now that, of course, were the leftists that were planning on doing that particular anti-election thing, too. But just imagine if Republicans actually said, you know what, we look at the race in Arizona, it stinks to high heaven. And for crying out loud, Florida's anything but honest. So we'll just tell those people, don't bother to show up at the Capitol building. And yeah, folks, I know what you're thinking. Gee, Mark, that won't work. Because the kind of crookedness we've seen here means these people are precisely the kind of swamp critters who'll feel right at home in the D.C. cesspool. In other words, it's pretty hard to keep rats out of the sewer. And just to put all of this in perspective, here's one more piece from Jim Hoft at the Gateway Pundit that reminds us that since Election Day, now that all of these recounts are in progress, an amazing thing has happened. Guess which party has won almost all of the seats? Democrats, it says, picked off over a dozen House GOP seats and two Senate seats, and they're not done yet. They may have had a decent haul on election night, but after the polls closed since Election Day, they've had a spectacular run. I guess it's easier if you know exactly how many votes you need to manufacture and where. In the U.S. Senate, Democrats have picked up two seats since Election Day. Montana Senator John Tester, who was behind on Election Day, had a huge haul after the polls closed and won by 5 points. In Arizona, the Taliban-supporting communist Kyrsten Sinema was declared a winner a week after the votes were cast, after she was fairly far behind on election night. While in Florida, as you no doubt remember, Democrats have discovered a secret stash of, so far anyway, 83,000 votes since the polls closed, and Senator Bill Nelson is only down by 12,000 votes there, and at the rate they've been manufacturing votes, that ought to be easy. Democrats have performed even better, he says, in the U.S. House. Since Election Day, they have added close to 17 seats from Republicans who, at the point where the polls closed, were winning. And guess what? There are still 11 House seats up for grabs. Guess who's going to be grabbing come hell or high water? All right, well, let's change gears now and talk about another place where elections obviously don't matter. Formerly Great Britain, the United Kingdom. And no, it's no longer so united either. Do you remember when the Brits voted to restore their sovereignty and leave, or Brexit, the European Union? June 23rd, 2016. The process was supposed to have started in March of 2017, and they were on course to leave, yeah sure, the EU by 30 March of next year. Don't hold your breath. And overnight, the father of Brexit and the former leader of UKIP, Nigel Farage, said he believed the draft Brexit plan now agreed on by Theresa May is, quote, the worst deal in history. The mastermind, says the Express, behind the Leave campaign, claimed that Prime Minister Theresa May had to be replaced with someone else prepared to go back to Brussels who would threaten to leave without a deal unless a free trade agreement was on the negotiating table. He branded May the, quote, worst and most dishonest UK leader he'd ever seen, and said that the worst deal in history is about giving away in excess of £40 billion in return for, quote, precisely nothing. Nigel Farage isn't alone in being upset at the British so-called leader. President Donald Trump was furious at Theresa May, said a companion piece from the Express, over Brexit, and his angry rant on Air Force One has now been revealed. The president raged at Theresa May during a phone call from Air Force One, saying the prime minister hadn't done enough to intervene in Iran, and he also criticized her over Brexit. Mr. Trump was flying to Paris last week, Friday, for a series of events marking the centenary anniversary of the end of World War I, where the president was said to have received a phone call from Mrs. May to congratulate him on the results of the not obviously yet completed midterm elections. But instead, says the story, she was met with a furious tirade. In addition to Iran, the WAPO said the president also questioned her approach to Brexit, which kind of seems to be, don't worry about it, if you judge based on what's been accomplished, folks. And ranted about how U.S.-European trade deals were being stacked in the favor of the EU. According to that paper, the U.S. and U.K. aides briefed on the conversation between the two leaders said Mrs. May was stunned by the tone of the president's call, although Downing Street has yet to comment on the report. And if you saw the other reports from over the weekend, folks, just maybe the president was revealing a bit of his displeasure with the major socialist leaders in Europe, especially the likes of Macron in France. So maybe she got off easy. While we're talking about Europe, two more quick stories from across the pond. Mark Zuckerberg, the socialist CEO of Two Facebook, has now refused to appear before an international grand committee investigating his company's role in spreading fake news. Says the Daily Mail, Rebecca Stimson, Facebook's head of public policy for the UK, turned down an invite from the government heads of Ireland, Argentina, Australia, Britain, and Canada to attend that hearing scheduled for November 27th, and in a letter to the committee, she wrote, Mr. Zuckerberg is not able to be in London for your hearing and sends his apologies. The Daily Mail reports there's talk about holding him in contempt, and as Damian Collins, chairman of the Digital Culture, Media, and Sports Select Committee, said at the time of Zuckerberg's response, it's not good enough. By dismissing our request, Facebook is failing to acknowledge its line of accountability, not only to legislators, but to its users worldwide. Now, here's the funny part, folks. They don't seem to be concerned at all about Facebook censoring politically incorrect speech. No, they're working on something in the EU called ACTA 2.0, which is literally the end of information freedom on the Internet. No, they're more concerned about what Facebook is doing to, quote, halt the spread of disinformation on its platform and protection for user data, unquote. So it's almost like when it comes to the stuff they're really interested in, from link licenses to outright censorship, Facebook isn't quite socialist and controlling enough for them. Obviously, they've got their own grand committee. Last week, I brought you the story of the first execution in the process of infringing the Second Amendment via what are called red flag confiscation orders. Now, the Baltimore Sun is reporting that the Anne Arundel County Police Department has released the names Tuesday of the two officers sick involved in the fatal shooting of a Ferndale man who didn't want his guns confiscated. Corporal Jessica Hooper and Officer Gary Zawadny, both five-year veterans of the department, were serving one of those new unconstitutional and due process-violating red flag protective orders to confiscate guns from a 61-year-old man, literally answering the door with a gun, because it wasn't even the crack of dawn yet. After he realized what they were up to, he became irate, and they killed him. Now, as you might suspect, people who can read the Constitution are beginning to call on the governor of the state of Maryland to suspend those red flag gun seizures, citing substantive constitutional questions like, gee, can you read? And they're also urging state legislatures to repeal the abomination. But here's the line in this story from the Baltimore Sun that raised your host's eyebrows. Details about the protective order, sick, oh yeah, they protected him, filed against Willis were not available because they are confidential under what now passes for the law, which took effect October 1st. So you don't have a right to keep and bear arms, obviously. You don't have a right to due process, also equally obvious. And we don't even have to tell you why it is that we might just kill you. And after the fact, you peons still aren't going to get told why we're doing what we're doing, as if it wasn't pretty much obvious. Can anybody see any constitutional questions with this? Oh, and let me ask one more. Do you really think an election is going to make any difference? Hardy har har. We turn finally to economics, because that really will be the entire load of straw that eventually breaks the camel's back. I'm looking at a story that I first pulled up over the weekend and talked about during the Sabbath teaching concerning hedge funds. Zero Hedge says they're bracing for a bloodbath come November 15th. Hey, that's Thursday. A few weeks ago they began, we reported that even when the market was hitting all-time highs ahead of the historic October bloodbath, hedge fund investors were growing increasingly nervous and rushed to redeem $15 billion from the space in the month of September, the largest single monthly outflow in years, bringing year-to-date net flows to flat after being stubbornly in the green for most of the year, despite what has been another deplorable year for hedge funds. This wasn't the first time either. Over the last 3 years, investors have removed $100 billion plus from the industry. But performance gains had offset these losses, at least until last month. But then came October, and it was not only a, quote, bloodbath across almost every strategy, but was the worst month for hedge funds in 7 years. Which is why, just a week ago, Zero Hedge warned about what may be the most underappreciated delayed risk to the market. A surge in redemption requests as investors get their monthly performance reports showing the worst month in years and in a knee-jerk response fax in their request to have most or all of their money pulled out before the rout accelerates. As of the weekend, even Bloomberg had picked up on it, with reporter Sajal Kishan warning that following the second worst month of the decade for the hedge fund industry, many are bracing for an industry D-Day come Thursday, November 15. Because that's the deadline for investors to put managers on notice that they want to get some or all of their money out before year end. And in case this is a surprise, folks, this is how it is in a managed economy. You see, it's not really your money. You can't get it when you might want it. And in the case of most of these hedge funds, although the numbers do vary a bit, investors who want to cash out must give 45-day notice before they're allowed to do so. They can change their minds about later not getting their money, but not the other way around. It does look like, say analysts, that this time only a few will change their minds, and the total redemption might end up being a bloodbath, because, if history is any guide, quote, the rush for the exits will be swift and accelerate. Zero Hedge goes through the numbers, other big sell-offs in recent years, and then asks, okay, why does this matter? Answer, because if there is a big flood of redemption requests come November 15, since there are few outperformers in the market, even the marquee names probably won't be spared. The question then becomes, who sells first ahead of everyone else in order to satisfy the calls for cash? In other words, keep an eye on stocks over the next few days as the great rush to sell before everyone else may be just beginning. Indeed, all the major indices are in the red as I do the recording today, but relative to recent sell-offs, not quite a historic bloodbath yet. So we'll wrap things up with a couple of comments from Michael Snyder at the Economic Collapse blog under his title, This Wasn't Supposed to Happen. Yep, we've deviated from the script because according to all of the experts, the stock market is supposed to quit plummeting after October's over. But instead, this month is starting to look a lot like the last, and investors are really beginning to freak out. U.S. stocks declined for a third day in a row on Monday, wiping out all post-election gains, and you can probably guess why. We've already talked about some of the big losers this week, but GE, Apple, and Goldman Sachs are also in the group, along with the so-called FANGs, the socialist media tech stocks. And the surging dollar and interest rates certainly do have investors worried, and there are warnings from the manipulated paper precious metals markets, too. Lots of paper, not so much metal. As Snyder summarizes it, are we seeing signs that the central banksters believe a new crisis is looming? Well, folks, there's certainly no shortage of indications why. Thanks for joining us today. Know the times and the seasons, and may Yahuwah bless you and yours.